And as was just asked a while ago, if I was going to start or three or four, we're going to be right there in three, and they're going to work our way into chapter four. We need to wrap up some things. Remember, we did a sermon a couple of weeks or maybe almost a month ago now in that latter part of chapter three. And so we had a little bit of groundwork, maybe if you remember. But our objective will be to cover this section here as we work our way into chapter four. I think we have some good things to learn, things that we'll build upon based on what we've already learned. And keep that in mind, the things that we have discovered, or maybe if we haven't discovered them, we reinforced with them, and then we keep those principles, those terms in check. They will help us with everything else that we're going to learn in this book, particularly in these first nine chapters. All right, before we begin, we're going to have a prayer. I'm going to ask Brother Elliot, if you will, to lead us in prayer this evening.
Blessing us in so many ways, giving us another opportunity to assemble ourselves here to study another portion of thy word, that we may learn more of your will. We ask thee, Father, to be with the teacher of the hour, that he may teach in such a way that we can learn much and apply to our lives. Pray, Father, for those who are sick and unable to be with us, that health may be restored and they can be back with us soon. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. The challenge with studying a book, in particular like Romans, for someone like me, I should say, I'll just make that clear, is that once I dug in and studied again the second and third time to get ready for this particular class, because I'd already did this a couple other times for some other classes in the last couple of years, is that when I get back in again, then I rediscover approaches, if you will, not necessarily brand new things, but an approach. And so consequently, I'm tempted to move away, like this evening. What I'm looking at now as I was reading through, because I go back and read the text before I start class. I read the text that week. I go back and refresh myself. I think about the things that I've said before. And then I find out, maybe if I could approach this a way, because this sounds like a good way. It's not that everything that I did before was absolutely wrong, but you're going to remember a few months ago was when I put this outline and text together. Now, I will give you this. The outline, I think, is pretty simple. It just follows the text, so I wouldn't really change that. But I might change questions. I might change an approach to some of them. Again, it shouldn't take us too far off. But what we are going to be looking at in chapter 3, as we can did in the last, we'll go ahead and cover these questions that we all have. And I've marked question number 23 for the Wednesday night. But then I got some more things that I want to add, because the important thing is to get the best that we can out of this for our use. And that's my aim. It's not to give you an overload of material, but to say, hey, this is a good thing. We need to remember it. And if we're going to remember some things, we need to remember these more than anything else. So that'll be the purpose. So I'll start off with question number 23, but like I said, I'm going to be kind of moving into the Bible text, which is good anyway, and you may not necessarily find your question asking anything of that necessarily. All right, question number 23. Why did Paul use the arguments that he did in verses 5 through 8? Okay. Well, the argument is rhetorical, okay? Let's look at back here in chapter 3, verses 5 through 8. But if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The reason I point that out now, because I wanted to start with that, is we're going to see this time and again. Paul's going to use this type of argumentation throughout this letter. The rhetorical questions. Okay, so rhetorical questions have one of two aims. Number one, you can have a rhetorical question which just states the obvious, right? It's not meant to be answered because everybody knows it to be so. That's generally how we talk about rhetorical, right? But there's another purpose of rhetorical, and it digs just a little bit deeper. And what it does is it intends to challenge you, and that's the point Paul's making. He isn't just stating an obvious. In fact, if you and I are approaching this book and look at these rhetorical questions, I'll be honest with you, it's not always that quickly obvious to us, right? So it ain't the same thing as me just stating what is obviously true. You know, I am bald, you know. But obviously, if I answer a question in regards to whatever that is, you guys would understand, you know, if I'm making light of that or if I'm trying to press some absurdity. And people do that. Preachers do that. Writers do that. But Paul is not just stating the obvious. He's intending to challenge the reader. He wants the reader to look in there a little bit closer, all right, to see what is being said. When we talked about God's righteousness, when he says, if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? See, now it's a rhetorical question, not stating an obvious, is it? Because did we say that God's righteousness or our unrighteousness demonstrates God's righteousness? Is that possible, ultimately?
For the contrast.
There's a contrast. But is God still right regardless?
Yeah.
That so Paul's not saying, okay, you get to do, you do evil, and therefore God's seen as a right man, or a right person, excuse me. He's right. No. But yes, there's a contrast. We see that. But that's for man's benefit, because God doesn't need that. Does God need the contrast? He doesn't want it.
If they understand that they're sinning, they can see the contrast to God's righteousness.
Right. If they are willing to pay attention to that. And this is where
that's
the...
That's why he asked the question. Make right. Them pay attention.
Yeah, he wants them to dig just a little bit deeper into their what they're doing and what they're thinking in regards to God and what they do before him. Obviously, there are great challenges whether they were of Jewish origins or Gentiles. In other words, they have wrong perspective sometimes, and that's why it becomes very difficult for these people. So he takes logical arguments and says, you know, let's look at this. If our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, well, what are we going to say about that? What are we going to say? He says, the God who inflicts wrath, he's not unrighteous. See, here's the necessary conclusion to that. And this is the dig deep part. If you think your unrighteousness is going to do some great favor for God or demonstrate or even help another man to see God, you're sorely mistaken. Because what you will do is you'll put God in a tenable position. Because you're saying God needs you be unrighteous in order for him to be right. Well, then if God's a righteous God, what is the necessary conclusion Paul makes that God must do?
Punish.
So then if he does that because you've shown him to be right, isn't God unfair? It's like sticking something out there and saying, hey, I want you to do this in order that I may look a certain way or good, but you're going to pay the price for it. Right? What? That ain't the kind of God we serve. That man might do that. But God doesn't do that. And that's what Paul is saying. Hey, don't put God in a tenable, don't put him in one of those compromising positions. Are we to say the God who inflicts wrath is the God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous? Is he? That's the obvious. See, in the rhetorical notice, the first part is to get them to dig a little deeper and think about what their unrighteousness compared to God's righteousness looks like. So it's not just a contrast anymore. In fact, what you do when you say those sorts of things is you say, guess what? God, you need to, what we're saying is everybody's got to be unrighteous, or people got to be unrighteous, or enough people's got to be unrighteous, so God will be seen righteous. Well, if God's seen as righteous and that's what he needs, then the problem is that you put God in a position of being unrighteous. And can God be unrighteous? No, it's impossible. So then as Paul says, I speak on human terms. I'm speaking from the human perspective so that you can understand exactly what we're dealing with here. It's absurd, isn't it? You see, he takes it and reduces it to an absurdity. That's the point of this rhetorical. So you got two aspects of it. One is to dig a little deeper, not to say what is obvious, the first question. And the second one, he states the obvious through a question so that we can understand what we're dealing with. So it gets us to rethink. That's the argument. All right, any questions about that? Okay, and then of course verse 6, he says, may it never be, or God forbid if the text you're reading says that, or certainly not. Those are kind of the three primary phrases that a lot of the English translations use. God forbid, may it never be, or certainly not. Either way, it's just exclamation, you know, no, far be it from you, Lord, right? Kind of thought. All right. So then what is Paul's conclusion in chapter 3, verses 9 through 20? What is his conclusion?
By the law is the knowledge of sin.
Okay, do what now?
By the law is the knowledge of sin.
Okay, all right. When you look at the text there, beginning at verse 10 in particular, when he says it is written, or this is as it is written, he says, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seek for God. And all have turned aside together, and they have become useless. And there is none who does good, and there's not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their path, and the path of peace they have not known. And there is not fear of God before their eyes. Now, just that section alone. What is the prominent, overwhelming condition of man?
Lost.
Yeah. Even worse than that. You see, when we say terms like loss, that says what our condition is in a passive way. You know, we're not saved. But what does he say in a very active way? We're unrighteous. Guilty, yes. Guilty as charged, unrighteous. That sounds a little stronger, don't it? Well, the poor fellow's lost. But what if the poor fellow's in harm or in danger? That's a different story, isn't it? You get the picture a little better, don't you? You see, sometimes we solve this. Yes, it is indeed true that we're lost, but you really got to get down to the meat of it and find out what that means. When you get into loss, let's talk about eternal punishment. Let's talk about weeping and gnashing of teeth. Let's talk about the fire, and let's talk about the brimstone. Let's talk about the heat on the end of Lazarus' tongue in Luke 16. Let's talk about that kind of pain and agony. Let's talk about not being with God. That's not a passive thing. Being in utter darkness, an absolute darkness with not even a glimpse of light. Take the darkest night that you can, go out into the swamps or out in the jungle, and you ain't going to find the kind of darkness that you're describing right here. You will find as much light as you need. Here you won't find any at all. And then he says, in your lost condition, here's what you're doing against God. This is the terms. When he says not one is righteous, he's not just saying, well, people just aren't doing good. They're actively against God. You do everything that's opposite of who God is and what God has created you for. You are bent against him. You can do it in small ways, you can do it in large ways, but it's irrelevant. He's not talking about the heinous criminals at the top of the list, and this is the pile here. He says, no one is righteous. That's the impact of this text. That's the impact of this. Does law have to be involved? Yeah, but that just happens to be the element in which God says, I'm going to show you that I care for you, so I'm going to give you the law so that you know how to be right. But the law is no good if you don't pay attention to it and aren't acting right. So God is telling us, Paul is obviously writing for God, that we are hopelessly unrighteous. We are full, notice, of cursings and bitterness. The poison of asp is under our tongues. Does that sound like a passive thing? Oh, happen to be lost. And if we use it in the common English vernacular, you know, my child could be out there somewhere and I don't know where they're at, and they're what? Lost. But they're not lost in the context of what we're talking about, right? You know, a fellow could be out there, as we say sometimes, and they're moving about and they're not finding their bearings spiritually, and they're lost. And if they stay in that condition, they're in trouble. But dear friend, that is not what Paul is telling us. That's not the perspective. There's plenty of other texts to go find that. He's not telling us lost here. He's not writing the story of lost here. He's writing the story of what? Bitter, vile, poisonous unrighteous, wicked are we? That's what he's writing. And what we need to understand as we read the scriptures, take into account the particulars of the context. Don't just pick your perfect or ideal vernacular of what we are supposed to be or not to be. Say, okay, this text will teach me about lostness. For instance, if I want to learn about lost things, where do I go? Incidentally, anybody know? Matter of fact, we might do a harmony of the gospel sometime soon. Luke 15, the lost things. You start off with the lost man, sheep, you got coins. You'll get to the parable of the lost son. So the point is lost things. That's the story of lost things if I want to study lost things. I ain't teaching lost things tonight. Romans does not teach me, not here anyway. He's not teaching me lost. He's teaching me hopelessly vile, wicked. When you think of a poison of an asp, as he says, an asp is like a poisonous viper. Take the worst snake that you can and see what he can do to you. Now you get the picture, don't you? That's the problem. You're not just lost. You're vicious. You're deadly. You're deadly. You're deadly. You're deadly to yourself and you're deadly to others. You're dangerous, right? That's the picture. None not righteous. No, not one. Their tongues are deceiving. The poison of asp under their tongues. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Get this. It's not even like the snake only. It's also like the one who's going to go out and kill and murder. Their feet are swift to shed blood, and destruction and misery are in their paths. That's what you're described as. That's what I am described as. Doesn't mean we have to be literally all of that in every case, but that's the description. You know what? We're not to back off. Well, which part am I? I'm all parts. I can't back out of this story at all. I can't say, whoa, no, it's not me. Yes, I am. And the path of the peace they have not known. You think about peace. We all like peace, don't we? Generally. Unless you're a real troublemaker and you live in a world of chaos, etc., you generally like peace. You get as old as I am now and you get tired of sometimes noises and you want a little bit of rest. You want a little peace, don't you? We think of peace. We live in a fairly peaceful society. We live in a peaceful community relatively. We don't like the loud noises. We don't like the trouble. We don't like the turmoil. We don't like the strife. He says, you don't even know what peace is. Peace is not even a part of it, what you know. He says, you don't know. The path of peace, you don't even know it. Now, you say, well, we know we're not talking about temporal peace. I get that. But the peace that passes all understanding, Philippians 4:7, is definitely under consideration. And that peace we better learn. That peace ain't really ultimately different in one way. And that when you think about the ideal of tranquility, you think about orderliness, you think about kindliness, you think about love, you look at taking care of others, caring for one another, etc. These are exemplary qualities of what peace is all about. Okay, so we need to remember that. So what is this 39 through 20, if I were to sum it up? I am a vile, wicked person, and I am not righteous before God. And now we're going to learn later on what it takes to make one righteous. We haven't got there fully, but we'll get there particularly in Abraham's story because he will stand out as our stellar example. All right? Now, yes, in verses 19 and 20, he says, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. And so, Joe, all that's telling me is that what I've told you about you unrighteous, I've already recorded it for you, and you have no excuse. Guaranteed, I know what I'm saying, God says. You are unrighteous. You are wicked. You are vile. Why? Because I said so. I gave you a law that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. I gave you a law. You didn't do it. Okay? That's all there is to it. It's that simple. I gave you a law. What we're going to see eventually as we move in through this is how law plays a role. Because he's still going to say, wait a minute. Before you get the impression that law has no importance, I'm going to tell you differently. You got it all wrong. Law is important. But law in and of itself has told you who you are or what you should do, and you haven't done that, and all it done is identified you as one that needs to shut your mouth and sit down because you're wholly unrighteous, okay? So therefore, there's where our part is, okay? Any questions about that? Now, ask question number 25 from verse 20's perspective as we wrap up chapter 3. What is true of law and any law? What can't law do? Let's put it that way. Maybe that's how it should have worded. What can law not do for you? Justify. That's right. Cannot justify. Think about that. Let's just, you know, you've probably heard this before. Let's just take some lawman. Okay, so let's take something very simple. You're not 16 yet, and you're not supposed to be under the wheel driving, but you fully are capable in your abilities. But you get behind the wheel, you start driving out here on the street. You have done what? You've broken the law. That law says that you cannot drive until you're 16, and you have to be licensed, permitted, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So all the law could do for you is tell you what you had to do and what you must do. Didn't justify, you did it. Right? Where's your justification in that case? Right, right, when you did that. Yeah, right, when you broke it, as Brother Miller said. Then it condemned you. But let's just say you did honor it and respect it. What did the law do for you?
Held you accountable.
Yeah, just held you accountable. That's it. It didn't justify you. You just...
Well, it's a witness.
It witnesses you did what you did right because you didn't do wrong. You know, nobody can claim you're under the wheel if you've not been under the wheel. You say, well, I ain't got a license and I wasn't driving, so I'm not accountable. I'm not responsible. I'm good, right? So it didn't justify you. It just simply said, this is what you're to do. And if you are a respectful person, and your parents are too in particular, they're not going to let you do that, and then everything's going to go well, right? Okay, that's the principle. The law just simply says, this is what I expect of you, man. That's what God says. Do that. Okay?
Then it protects you.
It protects you. It protects you because God says, my wrath will come on you if you don't or if you violate it. But as long as you don't violate it, you're good. There's no justification because think about it. The reason for justification is for what? Why do you need to be justified? Because you're guilty. And we're going to get to that argument. In other words, the reason you and I need justification is because we're guilty. But let's take that story a step further. The poor kid has finally got caught. Maybe the parents didn't even know it, and he's out on the street. So you got to go before the court and explain why this young man has been. And he's going to show up at court with you. And what are you going to try to do? You don't get justice because he's guilty. But you're going to beg for mercy. But when you do that, because the court, the judge in particular in these kinds of cases, he is an authority, right? And he has a right to do what? Justify you. He can justify you. I'll tell him myself. 21, 22, something like that. I racked up 6 speeding tickets in 1 year in the state of Texas. And I tell you what, the state of Texas back in my day did not play around. Next thing you know, I'm called to court to stand before the judge. You know what the fence was for that? I mean, what the penalty was for that? 1 year suspended license, no driving, right? You had to take defensive driving. You couldn't go nowhere for 1 full year. I stood before the judge. I'll have to say one of those was not my fault. I didn't actually do it, but I had enough that were against me. So at any rate, I go and I stand before the judge and I beg for mercy. I know he's just. I don't play around. I know the law says this. I'm not going to argue, whoa, one of those weren't, you know. It'd be foolish. I know he has the power to say, I keep my license or I lose them that day. And I ain't going to play around. I wasn't that dumb. I was stupid, but I wasn't that dumb. So I said, please. I realize I had committed these many speeding violations. And I realize what the law requires, but please, if there's any way, can you give me some mercy here? I've got work. I was going to school out of town. I said, these are going to be challenging things. But, you know, really, is there any way? And he says, okay, here's what I'm going to do for you, son. I had 6 months probation. I kept my license. One ticket. If I had one ticket in that 6 months, he was taking them away for 2 years. You're 21 years old. I don't know what they do nowadays, but in Texas back then, they didn't mess around in the late 80s. I know that. So the point I'm making is, he justified me. He justified me. Not because I was a righteous person. I was guilty, wasn't I? Right? But he allowed me, through his mercy, to keep what I wanted so dearly to keep in that case. I admitted my guilt, no hide. Is there any way? Now, obviously, we're dealing with the God Supreme. So this discussion should be a much more important one to us than our driver's license. But hopefully that gives you kind of an idea of what we're dealing with. The law can't justify me. The judge can. The judge can. And who is the judge? God. And what we have to find out is what God will do. Now, we have to meet the terms. Because remember, I had terms. The judge said, 6 months, no license, no ticket, son. I mean, not even a hint of a moving violation. I couldn't even park crooked. I mean, I'm not kidding you. It wasn't just speeding. He didn't say, well, it was speeding because I was up there for speeding. Any moving violation, and I don't know, those innumerable ideals probably. I couldn't roll through a stop sign accidentally. You know, I couldn't, you know, I don't know, park crooked. I had to mind my P's and Q's. He justified me.
He also incentivized
you. True. That's true.
That's what God does.
Yeah. But he showed mercy, and so therefore he gave me a good reason to do what I should. So, justification says this. I understand the law says you have been guilty of that law, and I desperately want to save you. I don't want you. I mean, technically, this judge was a very fair-minded man. He saw that I was an honest. I wasn't lying to him, and I wasn't trying to lay it on thick. I was just being so honest and straightforward, and he showed mercy. So this guy right here showed that he would exercise law in a very judicious way, and he did care. I mean, he actually did. He didn't want me to lose my license, is the ideal. Otherwise, what difference did it matter to him whether I lost mine or not? I still paid fines. I still paid court. I still did all of that. He didn't lose anything by letting me keep those. He didn't gain anything for it either. So, he had a desire. So maybe that's not a great example, but God has even greater reason. He loves us more than we can imagine. He loved us more when we were actually, as Romans will tell us, against him, hateful, vile. Then he stepped up and says, I want to save you. That's a rich story, even greater than the one that I offered. All right. So that presses us into the next section, which we already had the sermons on. And I know, Brother Prince, I told you in chapter 4, verse 5. We're going to see if we can't roll into there. I didn't want to spend as much time in the latter part because we did study that. But think about it. As he says in verse 21, but now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. We've already talked about that, right? The law and the prophets told us. Remember what I keep telling us even from Genesis, for those who are studying with us in Genesis. Well, even in Acts, what I did last night. What's important? What's important to remember about salvation? How does God deal with us in regards to the story of salvation? He tells us. He writes it down. He tells us through reliable resources. Guys, it's not going to happen in a still voice in the night. It ain't going to happen in a whisper in the wind. It ain't going to happen because you sweated just right and you felt just right. It ain't going to happen because of your imagination. And that's transcending all other aspects of what somebody might think. It's this simple. God is a very reasonable God. He wrote it down. He says, I witnessed these things through the law and the prophets even before these pages were written in Romans. I witnessed it. I showed you the pathway. I showed you what I would do. By the way, he didn't just say what I'm going to do to you if you don't obey, but he also told them what he would do for them in the future for their benefit because he loved them so much. I got plans for you, he says. I got plans. Hold on. Stick it out. I've got plans for you. And that's the ideal. So, again, Jesus is it, right? Because that's what the rest of the story goes on. Even the righteousness of God through the faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe, for there is no distinction. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Okay, remember what I've said before. Let me ask you again. Does anybody want to tell me, is there a difference between sinning and falling short of the glory of God, or is it just two different ways of saying the same thing? Is there a difference? It's not the same thing. Because really, if it's a compound sentence, it's not the same thing. If I sin and I fall short of the glory of God, what he's saying, surely a person that sinned, yes, has fallen short of the glory of God. We're not saying that one doesn't beget the other, but they're not the same thing. Because there's two avenues. Number one, I violated what God has told me to do. When I sinned, he said, do this, but I didn't do it, so I've sinned against him. That's guilt. Now what? I've also...
Because I've sinned, I've fallen short of the glory of God.
Yeah. So now I'm falling short of the glory of God. And you know what? That's the other element. It's not just, I want to go to heaven. I do want to go. It's not just that I don't want to go to hell. It's not just that, well, if I do this, then he'll give me some things. Bless me or whatever. It's about being like God. It's the glory of God that's the story. Remember Adam and Eve's problem. They sinned against God. But you'll see the story unfold in their sin in Genesis 3. Two things happened on the same day. They sinned against God. They violated his will. And then they fell short of his glory. Yes, one begets the other. But there is a fundamental difference, and that's why Paul writes this, because we need to see it. Because, friends, I'm going to tell you right now, if you think that all your concern is that I got to get this done just right so that I don't get condemned, you're missing it. And I promise you, you won't make it. Because that goes back to the checking off the list and the dotting the I's and crossing the T. It's not that we're not to do what God says or we shouldn't desire, but it goes back to this. If I don't have a heart to love God or want to be like him, and I don't want to have anything to do with his glory because that's just a lot of work and that's, you know, I just want to get by, then I'm going to miss it altogether. Why do so many people just scrape by in their life and try to get by and through this? Right, but it's the attitude of the heart, really, that when they approached God, they really weren't interested. I told you before, if someone is baptized out of fear of hell, that's a motivator, and that's acceptable. God tells us that. People afraid, like the Philippian jailer, had good reason, right? No problem with that motivation. But can that motivation sustain you?
No.
There ain't no way.
That's the beginning.
Yeah, it's a starting point, but that's it. And if you stay there, you're eventually going to leave there. You're not going to be fearful any longer, and you ain't going to care. If you don't strive to want to be like God, to seek the glory of God, to seek the wonders of God, to be in his presence, then you're not going to want to. It's kind of like the old adage they say, you know, heaven's a prepared place for prepared people, but I'm going to add one other thing to that that's just as important. Heaven's also a place where people really have a fellowship before they get there. They have an interest. So I'm not going to be shocked or surprised technically. Now, I'm not saying I won't be amazed or anything. I'm not trying to argue about that. I'm just saying I shouldn't be surprised about the company, right? It shouldn't be like, whoa, I got there. Does the scriptures teach getting by the hair of your chin?
No, it teaches by the proper attitude.
Right. And he says you can already know that. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7. Turn over there. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. Chapter 4, verse 7 and verse 8. Chapter 4, verse 7 and verse 8.
It says, I fought the good fight, I finished the course, I kept the faith. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing.
All right. Let me ask you this. Was Paul still breathing this side of eternity, or was he a dead man?
He was on this side.
Yeah. And he said confidently, what? The crown's waiting. It wasn't arrogant. It was confidence. He knew. Now, yes, his death's pending. He knows it. But all of us need to live like that, whether it be for physical, natural causes or otherwise. That's the idea. He knew he could be confident. But you know what? He already developed that relationship. And he said, hey, guess what? It's not just me. He says, all that have loved his appearing. All that have loved his appearing. I think what he says it in the text, if I understand it in past tense, it doesn't love his appearing. Loved his appearing. It's talking about the very first time he came. You loved the fact that he came is the ideal, because that's the reason you're saved. You loved that he came and died. You loved his appearing. And he says, all that do that, they will have the same reward, the same thing. And it's more than just the reward. I got the prize. It's the ideal, of course. It's a crown of righteousness, because he's been molding and shaping himself to be like God. That's the key. Now, we ain't got time to go through all of them, but we can go through example after example of people in the Bible who actually showed that and exuded that interest. And I'm going to tell you right now, that's the hardest thing for you and I to learn, or any man, really. And it's a daily exercise to rethink yourself, to make sure that you really, really are committed, that you really love God, you really want to. It's not no pie-in-the-sky dream, it's reality, it's concrete. It's saying, you know, this world is not my home, I say, right? Do I mean it? Maybe. Some days I do. Some days I haven't. I know. Sometimes I've showed up and the day's gone by. I know the tune. I can sing it. I don't even have to have the song book. But it didn't mean anything, because this world was my home in every way possible. I was thinking about this world. I had plans about this world. I had dreams about this world. I had all kinds of worldly plans. And I had this much for God, whatever that was. So the point is we've got to decide that we understand that sinning and falling short of the glory of God says, you know, God set us up to be a glorious people. He created us in his image, Genesis 1:27, right? We learned that he repeated that even in Genesis chapter 5. And we learned that that's God's aim, as he wants us to be glorified. Remember, we've already seen in our own book in Romans chapter 2. Repeat it again. Romans 2. Where am I? Romans. It's got to be in 2. Why am I lost? Yes, 2 verse 7. Man. To those who by perseverance in doing good, notice, seek for glory, honor, and immortality in eternal life. There's these different elements. Seek for glory. And really, I didn't really talk a lot about that when I mentioned it in the lesson. But here's the point. Glory is not just some accolade. It's like, oh, you got glory or whatever. It's seeking the glory that we gave up. The restoration of all of that. It's that intimate quality that God's allowing us to be in his presence. It's like this. There's some places you can go and some places you can't based upon your status, right? Economic, social, political, etc. You know, we're not going to walk up today, well, for lots of reasons, to the White House, right, and walk right in. We're not going to be able to, even if we were Catholic, to go into the Vatican wherever we wanted to go, right? We're not going to be able to walk into the state capitol at Florida or the governor's mansion, in particular governor's mansion, walk in just anywhere we want. We're not going to be invited. This is what's more important than the walking in. We're not going to be invited to every place. You're not going to be invited to Mar-a-Lago for a Trump dinner, right? You're not going to just invite yourself to that either, are you? You see, that we understand that we're talking about connectivity by relationship. Places that you are allowed and not allowed based upon the social norms. Well, now we got spiritual norm. And the spiritual norm is God says, I am right and I am good and I can only abide right and good. I have to have you to be right in order for you to be in my presence. And therefore, you got to work for glory. You got to seek it out. You got to seek for that which I am. If Christ was glorified even above what he was received already, in other words, not received, what he already had. As God, he was glorified. But Philippians 2 says he was exalted, right? Given more glory. Notice that. Philippians chapter 2. And he says in verse 9, for this reason, because of Christ's work, his death on the cross, God highly exalted him He was already an exalted person because he was God. But now God's given him an extra glory, as we would say. Highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name. Now he's already got that. Can you imagine you coming to his presence with anything short of that? Glory? Not short of that. I mean, all the exaltation. But short of glory, you got to have glory. You can't go in without it. So he says, seek it. Seek glory. Seek honor. Seek these things. Because if you do so, then you will be acceptable to him. But if you're not, then you won't be. It's kind of like getting yourself prepared. You know, we used to think in times past, dressing in certain ways for certain occasions. You dressed a certain way to go to church services, right? You went to a wedding in a certain way. You went to a funeral a certain way. Anything short of that would not be respectful. You weren't allowed in. There would be certain clubs in times gone by, and probably still today, that you're not allowed in because of your dress code or your social status, right? You got to get prepared if you're going to be ready for those. That's why young men work and go to school and get a degree or get a job or get an education or obtain money through their work and their efforts to get to those levels, because you're not allowed in. But God says, I've got a standard. Yes, but my standard's not impossible. It's not difficult. We'll see that, by the way, on Sunday morning. We're going to be looking at James chapter 1, verses 2 through 12. We're going to look at the hope in trials. And we'll look at one aspect of that. But here's the deal. We've got to seek glory if we're going to be a part of him. All right, so we didn't press forward. But Christ was it, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith. That's in verse 25 or 3. And this was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God he passed over the sins previously committed. In other words, because, and I didn't mention this before, I'm going to mention this on our way out, but this is very important. Did you realize that when God chose to forbear with us, to be long-suffering, to overlook the ignorance, Acts 17 and 30, when he chose that, he reached the pass of no return for planning our salvation. That's what that text is telling me. He showed himself to be righteous because he forbore, waited, while planning Christ to come. In other words, the only other option, if Christ wasn't the plan, was death. The only other option was there would be no other option. Man would have lost everything right then. Condemnation, destruction, and everything. And he says, I'm a right God, and not only am I right originally, but my righteousness is still proclaimed, though, because even though I waited to punish you, I'm still righteous because I'm still going to condemn. But the main thing, I'm righteous because I only waited till Christ came. That's why I could wait. Because Christ was my next measure. All right, we'll pick up there. Lord willing, on Sunday morning.